You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On the face of it, the U.S. jobless rate looks pretty good. Employment rose in July, and the unemployment rate stayed level at 5.3%. But GDP growth remains fairly low, and wages are barely keeping up with inflation. And other economic numbers might give cause for even more concern. In a new book called Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy, Virginia Commonwealth University professor Victor Tan Chen studies the effects of prolonged joblessness through personal interviews. He reveals aspects that may be missed in big data collection done by government agencies and economists. It's published by University of California Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Victor Tan Chen to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard. It's great to be with you.
Don't the data indicate that for the average working American, the employment picture looks pretty good now?
Yes, the employment rate has gone down in recent years, but for long-term unemployment, which was the focus of my book, we're still at historically high levels of that. Spells of unemployment, 6 months or more. A quarter of workers fit that description. During the recession, it was half of workers who were long-term unemployed. So the situation is still pretty fragile for many Americans.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, long-term employment increased considerably during the Great Recession. So we've recovered to some degree, but not as much as we might have expected?
Yes, especially this many years after the recession ended. We still have a lot of troubles within the labor market, both in terms of employment and unemployment. We have very low levels of people even in the labor market anymore, right? That's at a 25-year low.
When they talk about unemployment rates, are those people included?
Those people are not included. People who have just been so discouraged, they've dropped out of looking for work, right? That is the measure of unemployment we use.
Over 10% of unemployed Americans have been without work for 2 years or more. How many people does that turn out to be?
We're talking about millions of people that are out of work. And I think it is something that has stayed with us, as you noted, so long afterwards.
What's the standard explanation for why so many people don't seem to be able to get back at work? Or is there an explanation being given by economists?
There are several explanations. One is that they don't have the skills that are needed in this high-tech economy.
So it's their fault.
Yeah, that is basically what it comes down to. And that is the kind of view that a lot of my workers had, right? We have a more individualistic, go-it-alone kind of view of the labor market today. You know, you get education, you get the skills you need, you become successful, right, by yourself. I think we had a more collective approach to things in previous decades when we had strong labor unions and a sense that we could lift everybody up at the same time.
You're a sociologist studying something that it's often taken to be the domain of economists. Is there something that sociology can do that economics might miss?
Yes. I think, Leonard, you're looking as a sociologist at the social consequences of things like long-term unemployment. What I try to do in my book is tell the stories of individuals and families caught up in these structural economic changes. And I think you get at that level of detail that is lost in all the economic statistics, right? You mentioned the unemployment rate goes up and down, but what does that mean for real American families that are dealing with this job loss?
Who's most affected by long-term unemployment? Does it vary by age or gender or ethnicity? Did long-term unemployed tend to be older or, you mentioned earlier, less educated?
Yes. Education is key for being employed in this economy and avoiding the trap of long-term unemployment, right? And that's kind of lost sometimes when we talk about the college educator, right? Everyone's talking about how a college degree is no longer a ticket to the middle class today, right?
Or to a job, even.
Or to a job. You need to specialize in a certain field that employers want. But that said, Leonard, two-thirds of Americans over 25 do not have a bachelor's degree. That's a large segment of our population that fits that category. And they are increasingly being left out of this economy because of the decline of good jobs that paid well, provided benefits, and supported families.
I do have a bachelor's degree, but I don't think anybody ever really questioned me on that. Do people actually have to prove that they've gone to college and gotten a degree in English or philosophy to get a low-paying job?
It's not about low-paying jobs, because there are plenty of low-paying jobs in this economy, right? And that is the problem. The economy has seen a hollowing out of the middle of the job market. These kinds of good jobs, the jobs that my blue-collar auto workers had, unionized jobs, the jobs that people in offices, middle-class workers, white-collar workers have, those have been automated and outsourced away. So there's a lot of jobs at the bottom. There's Walmart jobs, there's McDonald's jobs. But what are the jobs that are going to support families?
You focus on auto workers in Detroit and Windsor, Ontario. Why auto workers and why include Canada?
Yeah. The auto industry and auto workers, I think, are central to the American story. This is an industry that put America on the map as an economic global power. And these are kinds of jobs that helped build a strong middle class in this country in the years after World War II. So I think they're a symbol of the past and the present and the future in terms of what is happening to these blue-collar workers, what happened to them in the 80s when the plant shut down. That is a symbol for what is happening today to white-collar workers.
Windsor is directly across the Detroit River from Detroit. As I understand it, the tunnel is just about a little under a mile, and you go right from Detroit into Canada. Is the situation for an auto worker in Windsor very different from their close neighbors in Detroit?
It's somewhat better, and that was the purpose of that comparison I did between American workers and Canadian workers, because I wanted to get a sense, looking at apples to apples, similar types of workers, what are the effects of social policies like unemployment benefits, like job retraining, like health care, on the well-being of these workers as they slip deeper into poverty. And the situation was somewhat better in Canada, but not as greatly better as I expected, because there too, the government welfare state, the safety net, has become frayed in recent years.
My guest is Victor Tan Chen. His book, Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy. Well, in the past, they said it was pointed out that because Canada had a different kind of a healthcare system, that employers were much more willing to go there with automobile jobs and such, because they weren't going to have to pay for their employees' insurance. Has that changed?
Well, there are limits to the healthcare system in Canada in terms of the benefits it provides, and Americans, many Americans probably don't realize that. But I think the growing competition that Canadians and Americans are facing is from places like Mexico, right? A lot of jobs have moved there. So even if you save on these kind of healthcare costs in Canada, how do you compete with lower paid Mexican workers in places like Saltillo, the Detroit of Mexico, right, where a lot of these factory jobs have moved?
Especially now, since the Canadian dollar and the American dollar are pretty much on a par with each other.
Yes, I think that wasn't the case when I started my research.
What's the age range of the people you spoke with? Do young people seek jobs with car makers these days?
Yes, they do. I think among the workers that I looked at, especially for the big three workers, Ford and Chrysler, these are people that have union jobs, right? So it's based on seniority, which is a different kind of system than many workers may be used to. And that meant that the people that were there in the plant, they've gone through waves of, layoffs, and the people there tend to be older. But I also studied, people in parts suppliers, and they tended to be younger, and dealing with more of the struggles of losing a sense of their identity, right? I mean, at a younger age, you can't take an early retirement. This is central to who you are, what you do. And they were struggling, especially those with families.
How diverse a group were the people you spoke to in terms of gender and ethnicity? And was it similar on both sides of the Detroit River?
Yeah, well, race is a difference in these two areas, right? There's a lot of African Americans that I talk to on the Detroit side, fewer on the Windsor side, more immigrants among the Windsor side of the border. And so that was a difference that I saw. And race plays a key role, as we know, and all of us who study inequality, because it makes the situation of unemployment worse when you do not have resources because of racial inequalities.
Well, Detroit was a magnet for people from the South during the 30s. Henry Ford hired African-Americans, so that made Detroit really attractive. But now Detroit is one of the sickest cities in this country, or the sickest city.
Yes. Again, another symbol of the future that might await many American cities, smaller cities that are seeing downsizing of various kinds. But you raise a good point, Leonard, about the racial dimension of things, because the United Auto Workers, the Union of Auto Workers, was a powerful force for workers' rights over decades, from providing or pushing for minimum wage increases, universal health care. And they also had a role in civil rights. I mean, Walter Ruther, the president of the UAW, was literally standing beside Martin Luther King Jr. when he gave the I Have a Dream speech. This kind of advocacy for working men and women, including African Americans, has been lost as we fall into an 11% unionization rate. Only 11% of workers are members of unions.
In the United States, state and local governments laid public employees off at greater rates than private employers did. How has that affected the agencies that provide services to the unemployed?
Well, one of the advantages of the approach that I took, the sociological approach, was to get at how these policies are experienced on the ground, right? You have all these good policies on paper in terms of benefits, in terms of retraining, and so on. But as you mentioned, Leonard, these agencies have been starved for funding. There's sluggish and impersonal bureaucracies that provide assistance. A lot of it has been outsourced to private contractors. So the quality of assistance matters, the implementation matters, and that was lacking.
If you're, let's say, 53 years old and have been unemployed for 2 years, how do you get by? Do you go to these places now privatized that deal with issues like unemployment?
Yeah, there's no good options for many workers. And I remember a story of one of my workers, John. He had worked in decades in construction and in the auto industry. He was in his 50s. His job meant a lot to him. He was raised by his grandmother because he was abandoned by his parents. And he said to me, my job was like my mother and father to me. It was, all I had. I depended on it. And, suddenly he played by the rules. He was, a good worker, a hard worker. But the rules have changed. And so, for people in their 50s, as you mentioned, how do you adapt to this changing world? How do you compete with people fresh out of college? Even if you get education, there's no good answers.
In comparing the Great Depression with the Great Recession, you write, the political tide has turned on workers. What do you have in mind there?
I think that we have gone through periods of a concerted kind of pushback against the institutions that help workers in this country, namely, labor unions and a more activist approach to government. I think that we could see just, examples of this in recent history. I mean, moderate Republicans used to support labor unions. I mean, Ronald Reagan was the president of the Screen Actors Guild, a union of actors, and pushed a strike that actually led to benefits for his workers. There was more of a sense that, unions were part of the democratic process, as the president of the Chamber of Commerce once said. So we've shifted away from that, and there has been a lot of lobbying and organization in the corporate sector to do that.
And unemployment benefits generally would be increased when we were going through a period of increased unemployment. But that's not the case anymore. Politicians have been actually voting to decrease the length of time people can get unemployment benefits?
Yes. They were extended during the recession, you know, through the stimulus package that Obama pushed for. But you're right. After the recession ended, those benefit extensions were cut off. And now in states like Michigan, they went from 26 weeks of unemployment benefits to 20. They are strapped in terms of their budgets, but there also is a sense that let's cut the budget on the backs of some of these workers.
How are the unemployed, especially the long-term unemployed, viewed in either the United States or Canada? Does Canada, is it look on, upon them a little more kindly than the United States? Is this a state-by-state situation in this country?
It's hard to say. With my study, I looked at how people responded to long-term unemployment, and I found that among the Americans, there was shame on both sides of the border, right, to being unemployed for so long. But among the Americans, there was more self-blame, a sense that they had done something wrong. They didn't get education. They didn't make the right decisions. And you have to make the right decisions in this risk-filled economy. And so there was a sense that they were failures in a society that really celebrates winning at all costs.
My guest is Victor Ten Chen, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University, founding editor of In the Fray magazine, and also co-author with Catherine S. Newman of a book called The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America Now. He is the author of Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy. It is published by the University of California Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Victor Ten Chen. His book, Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy, published by the University of California Press. U.S. carmakers have been cutting jobs since the early 1980s. Did something change with the Great Recession?
It accelerated a lot of trends that had been percolating in the background. And I think it was a way to cut the fat quite quickly in a lot of industries, not just the auto industry. But we have seen over the years a declining standard of living for middle-class families who have not seen their incomes rise since 1999. And I feel that, this is a broader indicator for what's been going on in various industries, not just blue-collar ones.
But in the case of the car makers, there was also a perception that American cars were inferior to foreign imports on the whole, and that was one of the reasons that the companies were shrinking. There's been some improvement in recent years, but how much has employment recovered since the bailouts of GM and Chrysler?
It hasn't recovered fully, and that is part of the story. There has been a much celebrated, rebound in those markets, and Chrysler and GM survived what they went through. But you're right; these decisions in the past, the focus on gas-guzzling SUVs and not perhaps enough on quality, affordable, sedans, things like that, were, in retrospect, bad decisions that hurt those industries that were once at the top of the world.
The subtitle of your book, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy, suggests a moral dimension to unemployment. You argue for what you call a morality of grace. What do you mean?
By a morality of grace, I mean a perspective of non-judgment, of acceptance, of forgiveness, of gratitude for life. I feel that it's an antidote to the hyper-competitive and hyper-judgmental society that we live in today, where everything we do is measured and evaluated and judged, from standardized testing in school to job performance reviews at work, especially in the job market. This is a concern. I feel it leads to an unhealthy kind of living where we are always obsessed with status and ranking and so on. And what I propose is a perspective of, grace, which is a concept in Christian theology. I'm not religious, but I find inspiration in this idea of getting beyond deserving and undeservingness, which President Obama actually spoke of recently in his eulogy for one of the victims of the church shooting in Charleston. This idea that grace is not earned, grace is not merited, is not something that we deserve. And I think this is a powerful notion that opens up some space for policies that can actually help middle-class Americans.
Some business leaders extol meritocracy, but you write the U.S. is what you call a stunted meritocracy. What do you mean by that?
Yes, at the top of the labor market among the high-flying workers, you know, we see lots of attempts to game the system in their favor, right? Whether it's giving advantages to their children, which is, you know, a natural tendency of parents, but it increases inequality, or, you know, explicitly changing the rules in the favor of their income, such as, you know, with Wall Street. And we saw that as a powerful example during the recession.
So you're saying the elite are protected from competition and economic downturns?
Yes. And
they've done that for themselves while they are not helping others to get through these same tough times.
Well, it's more than that, Leonard. Before we had a institution, labor unions, and a more populist government that could counterbalance those kinds of collective efforts at the top, right? Now it's kind of go it alone at the bottom, right? And it speaks to a lack of any champion for working men and women in the absence of those sorts of institutions that helped them in the past.
You write that attitudes of ordinary Americans and Canadians have mattered less than those of an elite circle of policy technocrats who worry incessantly and perhaps excessively about the trade-off between efficiency and quality.
Yes, I feel...
How does that apply to long-term unemployment?
Well, it leads to this sensibility, I think, among, you know, elites in particular that... you know, there are makers and takers, right? And the long-term unemployed are the takers, right? They take government benefits. They are not productive members of society. It's a kind of pernicious rhetoric that I feel makes the situation worse, especially for the self-blame that I found among some of my workers who, again, felt like losers in a certain type of world where you need to survive and prosper.
How did those workers, the ones you spoke with, understand larger economic issues that affect their jobs and the political issues that affect their jobs?
They had a sense of things like free trade, right? Things like the corporate movement of jobs overseas or outsourcing to lower paid areas of the country. You know, they had a sense of these things, and they were critical of them. But for the long-term unemployed, as you sink deeper into this hole of desperation, it becomes much more personal. It becomes a matter of you are at fault for this period of uncertainty because you didn't make the right decisions about education or about your career or so on. And I think that is part of the problem that people move in individually when there is need for a collective approach.
Is part of the problem that people assumed that there would be a job for them because they watch what happened to their grandparents and their parents, and now they got out of high school and they were going to go into the same profession mm-hmm. that their parents had been in, whether it was a car plant or something else, and then suddenly discover that they were in a totally different economy?
Yes, it has changed, and it's been changing for a long period of time.
Should
right?
they I have mean, been aware? Should the schools have been warning them?
Well, I think that the rationale for going into this kind of work was pretty clear. You could make good money in these kind of jobs, and I think you could blame them for not going that route. But these are the sorts of jobs that sustain communities, right? These are the sorts of jobs that provide a good standard of living, again, for the vast, you know, majority of people that are not going to go to elite schools and find those kinds of professions.
And that's the reason why so many cities in America's small towns are now suffering, because factories have closed, manufacturing plants have closed. You wrote an opinion piece in Newsday saying that we need to expect more from corporate citizens. What do you think they need to do that they're not doing now?
Well, again, Leonard, it's a question of values, as we were talking about before. I think that, you know, there is enough wealth in this country to provide a decent standard of living for everyone, there is enough in terms of profit to pay people a living wage for an honest day's work, right? And I think that we need to insist upon it. I think we let the market or think the market must dictate all these sorts of things. And yet we don't, you know, step up and change things, which we can do politically.
Well, every time there's talk about raising the minimum wage, somebody else points out that that is going to hurt the business, the small businesses, where people are going to be paid a lot more than they are right now.
Yeah. Well, I think that the biggest elephant in the room is, Walmart or McDonald's, or these are the companies that hire so many workers in our country. And, we need to start there in order to raise the standard of living for everyone. And, also there's this argument that, if people have more money in their pockets, if these workers have more money in their pockets, they can also spend money and support businesses.
That's what Henry Ford used to say. If they have money, they're going to buy my cars.
Yep. That's why he doubled the wage of his workers to, make them more productive, but also allow them to buy Fords.
So in the very limited amount of time we have left, what do you think needs to be done to reduce long-term unemployment or to improve the prospects for those who've been unemployed for months and even years?
I think there are two things we should be focused on. One is policies. And my book, looks at the importance of even small policy differences, things like healthcare, things like job retraining, that can make a difference in the experience of unemployment. I think we need to focus, too, on organizing and having a grassroots movement, whether it's in labor or in other causes, that can energize people about efforts to bring about equality.
Aren't we moving in the opposite direction?
Well, there's...
I look at some states where teachers' unions, for example, have been under serious attack. And in the past, the right-to-work states tended to be in the South. Now they're pretty much all over the country.
Yeah, Leonard, that's really why I focus on culture in my book as a solution, because I feel that we need some kind of cultural change in order to, this idea of grace is about getting beyond this kind of makers and takers rhetoric and saying, we can help people who are suffering if we don't just blame them for every mistake they've made. We have the capacity to do that. Whether we have the will is a question of values, and I think our values have gone in the wrong direction.
My guest has been Victor Tan Chen, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University, founding editor of In the Fray magazine. And his latest book is Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy, published by University of California Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much, Leonard.